If you look at history, you will find that the Germans have made an awful commotion in the world, all the way back to the time of Attila the Hun. So Mr. German, who is being so cross because he can't get my books in German, I don't want them published in German, and I wouldn't care two hoots. I couldn't care even half a hoot what Germans think about it. A gent here, I am sure he is a gent by the way he writes, believes that it must be wonderful to be an author. You don't do any work, you just walk about a room dictating to a staff of secretaries who hang on every word that the author utters and then struggle to put those words into beautiful prose that will hypnotize a publisher into paying wonderful royalties. This fellow thinks that all authors are millionaires, all authors fly about the world with first-class tickets, or perhaps I should say first-class credit cards, and drive whacking great sports cars or Rolls Royces. Do you think I could take a minute or two to tell him to wake up? It's not so easy as all that. I believe the late Edgar Wallace had a formula which was like a skeleton of a book, and he kept on ringing the changes, having about six or seven different sets of plots whereby he hung different names, different locations, and different crimes onto that book skeleton, and then he used to stride about the room with a long cigarette holder in his hand dictating out of the corner of his mouth, "You have to if you are smoking at the same time," to two or three typists. Well, that is mass production. The average poor wretch of an author doesn't do it that way. Anyway, do you know what true books need? Let me tell you. First of all, if you are going to write a true book, you must have had some true experiences, you must have had some horrible experiences which scar you for life. People who have been in prison camps, for instance, are never the same, they are scarred, often their health has deteriorated and is deteriorating as a result of their experiences. So they have the knowledge of certain things. But then they have to be able to write, they have to be able to put words describing their experiences in passable interesting form. If they can do that, then they have to be sure that their experiences are such that people want to read about them. After they have typed the book, they have to get a publisher to read the typescript, but first of all, before a publisher will consider such a typescript, you have to have certain mechanical disciplines. You seem to be interested, so I will tell you about it. You have to type on one side of the page without too many mistakes. You have to have double line spacing. You count 10 words to each line, and 25 lines to each page. That gives you 250 words to a page. Now a chapter in my average book consists of 20 pages, that means 5,000 words, and I usually have 12 chapters which adds up to 60,000 words. And when you've got up to 60,000 words, you find you have left out something important, so you add on a few words more. It is, it seems, very necessary that you get your chapters much about the same length, because you don't get one man to set up your book. The book is divided between a number of typesetters, and if one gets short chapters and another gets long chapters, well, there might be trouble with the union or something. So it's better to get your chapters fairly even, about 5,000 words to a chapter, perhaps with a bit shorter chapter in the beginning and a bit shorter chapter at the end. So if you can do that and your typing is neat enough, then you may get a publisher to read it, and reading a typescript is the first step to getting it published. By far the best method of getting a book to your publisher is to use the services of an agent. I have a very good one indeed. Throughout the years we are not just agent and client, but I consider Mr. Knight as my friend. He is that jewel of agents, a completely honest man. It is, obviously, absolutely necessary that your agent be honest and work on your behalf. The name of the firm is Stephen Ask, of 39 Victoria Street, London, England. But I must warn you that if you send muck which will never have a chance of getting printed, then an agent is justified in charging you a reading fee. So if you, full of literary zeal, feel a compelling urge to write, then you would be well advised to get in touch with an agent such as Mr. Knight, enclosing return postage, and you will ask him his advice: is there a market for such and such a thing, etc. If there is, he will tell you so, And he will undoubtedly suggest that you do a synopsis of perhaps 5,000 words telling briefly what the book is going to be about. Don't send stuff without writing first, and don't expect an agent or an author either to answer your letter unless you put in entirely adequate postage. An agent has to pay for printing, he has to pay for typing, he has to pay for time, overheads such as electricity and heating, etc., taxes on his building, rent on his building, and if you do not observe the decencies of life and enclose adequate postage, your prospective agent may just do what I should do, toss the stuff in the garbage. A good agent is invaluable. He will get in touch with publishers in other countries, and he will get after publishers to pay on time, and believe me, some publishers do not. But if you think that you are going to make a fortune out of writing, go out and pick up a shovel and become a builder or something like that. These are the people who make money nowadays. The author, unless he's got something particular to say, often does not make enough to live on, and a hungry author is a horrible sight indeed. People write to me asking what I recommend in music, people who want to be elevated, raised up, given spiritual uplift and all that. Well, it is very appropriate at this moment because I have just had a letter from a young man in England who takes me to task because of what I have said about present-day music. Not only that, but he sends me a sample of what he considers to be good music. I have no record player, so a friend of mine tried it, and apparently the result is that the poor friend is almost a friend no longer, because the music was jangle, jangle, bang, bang, like a procession of mad garbage collectors with street vitus dance beating garbage can lids together. Hey, I wish you wouldn't send me some of these hard rock records. My. You'll make me lose my few friends if you do. So take warning from this, I have no record player. I believe that music should be soothing, it should be the type of thing which makes a feeling of goodness, the sort of music which raises your vibrations. I believe that a lot of the neurotic tendencies in life nowadays are caused by unsuitable music because, you see, when you listen to music, your own personal vibrations vibrate in sympathy or as a harmonic to that which you are hearing. So if you are listening to a lot of disturbing jive, I think that's what the stuff is called, your own personal vibrations will be set on edge. It seems to me that so many nervous complaints have been caused by imitation stereo belching out hard rock at enormous volume and really upsetting one's psyche. So if you want to progress spiritually, you will start listening to some of the old masters, some of the definite classics, some of the music which the younger generation will not listen to and perhaps never have listened to because they think everything to do with the establishment is against their interests. We get much the same type of thing with the radio nowadays. One is trying to listen to a good musical program. And, over here on the North American continent at least, we get interrupted with hysterical announcements that Gloss pills will cure everything from constipation to corns. Well, that is very bad, not the constipation or corns, but the sudden frenetic announcement uttered in hysterical tones, because it completely shatters the soothing vibrations which had built up through good music. So if you want to listen to good music, get it on records or on tape so that you don't have a hysterical young man bawling the love song of patent medicine. Dr. Rampa, the letter said, you have done 14 books so far, are you going to go on writing? I think you should go on writing. I think you should write until the end. Well, madame, you refer to 14 books. This is the 15th, this twilight, and why shouldn't I write some more, as you say? After all, I might get as far as midnight. Who knows? It depends on the public demand, because a publisher won't publish books unless there is a demand for them, and there is no guarantee, you know, that an author can write a book and be sure of its acceptance. An author is like a blind man, he has to feel his way. So if you want more books, why not write to my publisher and ask for them? If you want better covers, and I surely hope you do, then why not write to my publisher and tell him so? And if you do not like the fading yellow paper which the publisher uses, well, please tell him. Do not tell me, because I assure you on all the holy books there are that I have no say in the matter of covers, illustrations, the type of paper used or the size of print. So you beat up the publisher instead. It's something I cannot do. People write to Ms. Gray and to Mrs. Fifi Gray Whiskers. Of course these two ladies are no longer on this earth. A cat's life is a very short life, you know. They live about 7 times faster than a human, so a year in are 7 years in a cat's time. Now Miss Cleopatra is, in cat time, nearly 60 years of age. Miss Cleopatra Rampa is a seal-pointed Siamese cat, and I say in all seriousness that she is the most intelligent person I have ever met, no matter whether that person be human or what. Miss Cleopatra is by far the most intelligent, most sympathetic, and most loving of all. She looks after me. As you know, or should know by now, I am ill, and a short time ago I was very ill indeed, and it was enjoined upon me that I should not move more than I really had to. Well, Miss Cleopatra took it upon herself to sit by me at night. She sat on a little bedside table which I have, actually a hospital bed table, and she would sit upright all night, and if I dared move more than she thought necessary she would reach out and give me a thoroughly hard slap as if I was a bad child whom she was disciplining. She does do rounds just like a hospital nurse. When she is not on duty full time by my bedside she will come in several times during the night and very quietly jump on my bed, of course I am not supposed to know, and then she will creep stealthily up beside me and peer intently into my face to make sure I am breathing satisfactorily. If I am she will quietly go away. If I am not she makes a commotion which fetches other people. All the time I have known her I have never known Cleopatra to be irritable or cross or anything except absolutely sweet-tempered and reasonable, and if there is a thing that one doesn't like her to do one can just tell her so in an ordinary normal voice and she will not do it anymore. Buttercup, for example, did not like little people sitting on her hats which presumably, from a woman's point of view, is reasonable. She told Cleo without anger, without irritation, and Cleo hasn't done it since. Fat Taddy lives with us as well. She is a blue point Siamese cat, much heavier than Cleo, and she is not so intelligent in a material, physical sort of way, although compared to other cats she is highly intelligent. Her particular talent lies in the realms of telepathy. She is the most telepathic creature I have ever met. And when she wants to she can get over her message as loudly as a public address system blaring in one's ears. She is the responsibility of Cleo who more or less shepherds her around and sees that she behaves herself. But Cleo is my special guardian. Taddy is more interested in guarding the food. People write to me, as you may have gathered, and ask all sorts of strange questions. They ask all sorts of personal questions too. For instance, they want to know my age, which is nothing to do with anyone else. Some of them want to know if I get the old age pension, and I am able to tell them that I am not able to get the old age pension for what I consider to be a strange reason. I spent some time in South America and because I have not been back in Canada for 10 years I cannot get the old age pension. So any of you who are senior citizens might be interested to know that according to Canadian law one has to be in the country for a complete and entire 10 years even if one is a naturalized Canadian citizen before one can get the old age pension. In 1975 I shall have been back in Canada for 10 years, so then if I am still alive I have to sign a form so that another person can collect the old age pension for me as I cannot go in person to do it. I am also asked if Mrs. Rampa still lives with me, and I was about to say, well, obviously she does, but in these days of sudden or instantaneous divorces it's not so obvious anymore, is it? So let me say yes, Mrs. Rampa does live with me, and so does Buttercup, Mrs. S. M. Rouse, who lives with us as a member of our family and as a very important member of our family at that. Sometimes I get offensive letters from Australia. I had one letter from Australia from a man by the name of Samuels. He wrote to me in a thoroughly unpleasant manner saying that there had been no word from Mrs. Rampa and if I was genuine why didn't Mrs. Rampa say so? Well, actually, she has done so, many, many times. But I'll tell you what, I'll let Mrs. Rampa start the next chapter with a few uninhibited words unguided by me, undirected by me, so she can say what she likes. So, Mr. Publisher, will you put on some soft music, dim the lights over our readers, and prepare to illuminate the spotlight, because for the next chapter we will have Mrs. Rampa start it. Chapter 11, let me here introduce Mrs. S. A. Rampa. I have offered her the opportunity of saying what she wants to say, so here it is. It had been suggested that I should make a small contribution toward this, the 15th book, write a chapter, for instance, and at first the thought gave me quite a shock. No. I would not presume to try for a chapter. But as the author agrees, I will be very happy to make a few comments. This evening I finished reading the typescript of Chapter 9, which was hot off the typewriter, and I believe Chapter 10 is also completed, but that one I have not yet read. So if I do not hurry I will be too late for this book. As I was going about my evening duties such as watering the plants, preparing our supper, and attending to the very small needs of Cleopatra and Tadlinka, my thoughts were dwelling on the material I had been reading in the pages of Twilight. First of all I would like to mention that when Lobsang Rampa refers to my wife or Mrs. Rampa, it is still the same creature who is known by other names in previous books. It is still Ma of Living with the Lama or Mrs. Old Man of Beyond the Tenth, and Rab of Candlelight. It seems appropriate that you should be assured that Lobsang Rampa is a loyal and devoted person, and is not in the habit of frequently changing his partner, and I hope the same can be said of myself. Many things have been said for and against us just the same as they have criticized the President of the United States of America, who has just reluctantly relinquished his position as President. Like President Nixon, we have suffered greatly at the hands of the press, and during the past few days we have been reminded that the critics with the least knowledge have the most to say. Were it not so, these people would be engaged in formulating better conditions instead of trying to break down the best efforts of a few others who are striving to do some good for their fellow men. But criticism is not my purpose tonight. Rather do I desire to make a few comments about the author of this book, Twilight. Dr. Rampa is not the gruff, embittered old man portrayed by some thoughtless persons. Indeed, he is extremely sick and therefore has enough cause for gruffness and irritability, but he is not horrid and touchy. Instead, he is continually thinking of others, and during the last week I have noticed more closely than ever how great is his compassion toward those who are in distress. Last night we listened together, as did people around the world, to the tragic announcement of the impending end of a presidency. And Dr. Rampa was so deeply moved by the sadness of it all that he spent a more than usually sleepless night. One of the things which causes this extreme sadness was the attitude of the reporters. They did not merely do the job of reporting but, to repeat expressions used by another listener, they were sprayed with hate. Perhaps I should apologize for the length of my commentary, for it had been intended that this would be just a few lines. There is just one further point, and I want to put it on record now, for it may be the only opportunity I will have, that I personally owe my outlook and my whole attitude to life to this man who has sacrificed so much to help us, and especially to help me. Although life is not always easy, one does not mind so much if one can see where one is going, and, as we have been told often enough, there is no shortcut to tranquility. From personal experience I can state definitely that however difficult, however impossible we consider ourselves to be, with a little effort and regular practice we can overcome many of our problems, making it easier to live with others, and, just as important, easier to live with ourselves. In my own case, the teachings and, even more important, the example of Lobsang Rampa has been the greater factor in assisting me to come to terms with myself, resulting I hope in my being a somewhat better person. I do not know whether there will be space left in the book for this modest contribution because it had all been planned before I could arrange my thoughts. However, the writing has been enjoyable, and I wish there had been more space so I could tell of various incidents depicting the very compassionate side of the nature, The side which is not familiar to everyone, not always recognized, but which nevertheless is a very real part of the Lobsang Rampa makeup. Still, there may be another opportunity. Who knows? But I know this, in answer to that offensive man in Australia who wrote demanding that I prove something, let me say that yes, I know without possibility of error that Lobsang Rampa is who he claims to be and that all his books are true. Well, I had hoped that if we were going to have illustrations they could have borne the signature of S.M. Rouse, and I also hoped that if blocks were made for illustrations, the foregoing paragraphs by Mrs. Rampa could have borne her signature, because there is always some creep ready to say, "Oh by golly, he wrote it himself." But he didn't. As for this proof business, well, there is no point in trying to prove a thing to anyone, because if a person wants to believe then he will believe, and if a person doesn't want to believe then no amount of proof at all will convince him. So you make your own choice. But another thing I have been asked is about books. What books should people read? Well, I can't give a whole list of books because I don't have many myself, but two books in particular have greatly impressed me, and I will give you the two titles and the necessary data. The first is The Spaceships of Ezekiel by Joseph F. Blumrich. That is a corgi book, and I can most truly recommend it. The author nearly laughed his head off when his son told him about UFOs, and the author is a NASA scientist, a man well qualified to know about UFOs and all that. He was so amused by his son's stupid belief in such things that he set out to prove that there couldn't be any flying saucers. The more he tried to prove, the more convinced he became that there were such things, and in the end, as a designer, he was able to design the type of spaceship which was written about in the times of Ezekiel. But it is a thoroughly good book and one that I absolutely recommend, so put on your running shoes and rush around to your local bookstore and buy it, and you will see that I am a good book critic. Another extraordinarily good book is called Timeless Earth. It is written by Peter Colosimo. I believe it was first written in French, but it has been translated into English by Paul Stevenson, and it is published by University Books Incorporated. I am glad they have some incorporated because they need it for printing books, don't they? This is another book which really will hold your interest. It tells the truth, and it should be in the library of every serious thinking person. While you were rushing around for the spaceships book, how about picking up Timeless Earth as well? You might find your education has been improved thereby. Hey, I'm being good in this book, aren't I? I'm not just answering your questions, I'm also recommending other authors. But let us get on with some more of our questions and answers. Let me make a confession here. My sight is very poor, so I have been cheating by picking out the letters which are typed, because sometimes people write to me and their handwriting reminds me of the squiggles which would be made by a spider suffering from S.D.Vitus Dance, who had just crawled out of the inkwell. No doubt many, many questions which would be most interesting have been overlooked because I could not read the writing. There is a question here, though, which doesn't at all follow in the writer's supposition. The young man says, "You say that we are all immortal, however wouldn't it be logical to say that if we have no end we would also have no beginning? Wouldn't it make it more logical to make it go both ways?" No, I don't think so, I don't see that at all. After all, a thing has to begin, otherwise it is not, and once it has begun why shouldn't it keep on? In theory, you see, if a person could exactly replace all his body cells in precisely the same pattern as the ones he was replacing, then he would go on forever and ever, wouldn't he? A person wears out for the simple reason that the mechanism which replaces cells increasingly has a defective memory, and so the cells which are replaced and the cells which are replacing are somewhat different and grow increasingly different. I, quite bluntly, cannot see any reason why a thing should not start but not end, and, anyway, Mr. L., what do you mean by no ending? We go on and on, there is an end to the human body, the physical body, and then we go on into the astral, and in the fullness of time there is an end to the astral body. In other words, we die quite painlessly in the astral and pass on to another dimension, and so on, and so on, ad infinitum. Is there such a thing as a half or quarter dimensional world? This question has been puzzling me for a long time. No, there is no such thing. You have to have a complete dimension, otherwise you would get interaction. You get a similar state of things on a very, very minor scale when this world and our negative world come in too close proximity. You get people disappearing, such as at the Bermuda Triangle, but these cannot be called half or quarter dimensions. It is just a misfortunate, not unfortunate, happening. Dr. Rampa, why do the press find such sick joy in persecuting you just because you come along with a very special task that needed to be dealt with? Do they not believe that you are perfectly truthful in everything you say and do? You have rights, you know, and they should respect them. Of course, I've done nothing to make the press like me. But I have done nothing to make the press dislike me, either. You see, press people come along with a fierce, threatening demand. They demand that one give them an interview and say whatever the interviewers want said, and if the victim doesn't agree, then he is set up for press persecution. Some years ago, I received an offer from a TV station. They wanted me to go on television and tell the truth of the Rampa story. I was perfectly willing to do so because all that I have written and said is the truth. I am whom I claim to be, and I can do all that I write about. So there I was, all ready to go on television. But then, to my profound amazement, I found that they did not want truth. Instead, they wanted me to read a prepared statement saying that I was a fake. Well, I wasn't a fake, so I would not read the statement, so I was not permitted to go on television and tell the simple truth. Instead, I was persecuted by the press. I wrote to the press council in England complaining of all the vicious lies which were being written about me, but the press council thought the press should have freedom to write whatever they wanted to write. I also wrote to the governors of the TV station, and they thought that a television producer should be given the freedom to say whatever he wanted to say on television and to require that other people do the same. So it seems to me that the press, the radio, and the television are a closed shop. Now, I am going to ask you a question. If you were attacked by the press or on the radio or on television, and you knew quite definitely that what they were writing or saying about you was lies, how could you refute those lies? Remember, you can't get published in the press unless they want to publish what you write, and you can't broadcast or appear before the television cameras unless someone wants you to. So there is no way in which you can defend yourself. Someone may say, well, take legal action. Yes, fine, but that takes a lot of money, and it cannot be done unless you have a lot of money. I tried to do that against a man in the USA, a man who was pretending that he was publishing my books, or rather publishing books written by me, when they weren't by me at all. He was making use of my name, but I tried to get a lawyer to act for me, and because I lacked the money to pay the fantastic advance he expected, nothing was done. I have had to see people use my name, misuse my name, pretend to be me, and all the rest of it, and there is nothing I can do. If I had the money, or if some lawyer would be paid by results, then, by golly, I certainly would make a case against a few people, against a young punk, for instance, who pretends he is my bosom friend and that he is selling articles direct from Lobsang Rampa's workshop. As I told you before, I do not have a workshop, I do not make articles anymore. And if people pretend they are my friend and that they can use my name, then remember there are only two people who are making things designed by me: Mr. Sota in England, and Mr. Orlowski in Prince Edward Island, Canada. You talk about a world leader whose body is presently being prepared on the earth and for the great entity to come and animate it. Do you know where the body is presently living? Could the entity who is going to come and take over the body be the reincarnation of Jesus, Muhammad, or Gautama? Oh yes, I know precisely where the body is, and I have actually seen the body. But, of course, I wouldn't say where he is, or we would find some crummy pressmen rushing off and coming back with some fantastic, entirely imaginary article. I definitely know where the body is. No, Jesus, Muhammad or Gautama are not reincarnations and they are not coming to take over this particular body. You see, there is a special group of entities who come down to Earth at certain times.